This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to another podcast from InsideCarolina.com, the independent voice of UNC Sports. Brought to you by JohnnyT-Shirt.com, the go-to provider for all your Tar Heel gear.
I'm your host, Tommy Ashley. Listen to the Inside Carolina podcast, the 40 Club podcast. We'll explain it a little bit later. If you're not familiar with the name of our podcast, I've got my main man, Joey Powell, with me. If you're looking on YouTube, take a chance to subscribe to our YouTube channel. If you're listening on iTunes, subscribe, rate us, do all that good stuff. It helps us move up the charts on some weird algorithm that iTunes has.
I was told there would be no math, Tommy.
There is no math. I did not do well at math when I was at Carolina. I bet the guy that we have as a guest did well in everything, as he's done well in life. If you're looking on YouTube, you may recognize him, Mr. Damian Grant. I appreciate you taking time to join us.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on your show. Thank you so much.
Debo already gets the award for biggest guest that we've had so far.
Is that what it is?
Not even close. We'll send that trophy in the mail to you real quick.
I appreciate that. Just give it to Tommy. He'll deliver it to my house.
Yeah, really. So that's funny. So let's break the ice and talk about how Mr. Grant ended up on this podcast. So we live in a little town east of Raleigh.
Yeah.
We'll put it that way.
Say that.
And I'm at the pool one day, and my son comes up to me and taps me on the shoulder, and he's like, "Dad, look over there." And I look over there, and he says, "That guy played basketball at Carolina." And I couldn't see you standing under the awning over there, or under the thing. And I leaned up and I said, "Oh, that's Debo." And he said, "Who is Debo?" Kids today. Yeah. And then you came across, and I believe that's what I said to you first. So we ended up talking at the pool, and here we are today. It's just a small world, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. And then when you came over, you're like, "Debo," and I was like, "Okay, so this guy must know me, because only people that know me is Debo."
Well, it was funny to me is that those teenagers had no clue who that was. So
yeah,
we got to get those young guys educated.
That's unfortunate.
So let's like I mentioned, it's the 40 Club podcast. We sort of came up with that name since we started doing these. We talked to your buddy Jawad. We've talked to Michael Brooker, and now we've got you. And we'll explain more about why the 40 Club is a thing. But Damian, you know, you're a guy from Hope Bay, Jamaica. First of all, for us, I'm from the country, so I understand small towns, but describe Hope Bay, describe where you grew up, and then I kind of want to get into how we wound up here today and the journey it took to get us here.
Yeah, so Hope Bay is a really small town on the north coast of Jamaica, in the parish of Portland. It's about, most people are probably familiar with Port Antonio. I think it says in some of the bios that I'm from Port Antonio, but I'm actually from Hope Bay. It's about 10 miles west of Port Antonio. Very small, considered Fisher's Village, or actually not a village, but town. Only a few thousand people, has a police station, a few churches, everybody knows everybody. And, but yeah, my parents grew up there. I hope, you know, that's considered home.
So you played cricket and soccer. Now,
yeah,
I know how big you are now. What is a six seven guy playing soccer?
Please tell me you weren't a fullback. That's all I wanted. Please tell me you weren't a fullback.
So, but yeah, actually, I played cricket, soccer, and I ran track. you know, for my primary school team growing up. And so never played basketball at all growing up. Didn't really think about it. It wasn't a sport in Jamaica. Basketball wasn't big at all. And I didn't even watch the game because, you know, we didn't have cable. So we had one, the local TV channel, which of course didn't have any basketball games. It was all local shows and local news. That went off the air at noon and then came back on at 3 p.m.
Forces so that we need that these days. Get kids
so
outside.
That's what I have. But yeah, so grew up because that's what everybody else, all the other kids were doing. So, you know, that's what all the other kids were doing. And so that's what I did, you know, and it being tall. Yeah, I was tall, but with running track, with playing soccer, you know, I was an athletic kid. I was quick. So, I mean, it definitely contributed to a lot of the things I eventually started to do.
So as you've lived, you know, your entire life, you know how this works out, where they see the tall guy, like automatically he must be great at basketball. But tell us, how did basketball become a part of your life? You know, you had all these other athletic things that you were good at and that you were doing. At what point did somebody introduce basketball to you and get you out there and say, hey, try this out?
So it's a crazy story. My grandfather lived in New Jersey, and in Jamaica, being a tall kid, I didn't have, and I had big feet, didn't have the resources to be able to buy shoes. And, you know, at the time I was wearing a size 15, couldn't find size 15 shoes in Jamaica. So my grandfather living in New Jersey, he would buy shoes and get them shipped to me. So he went into a shoe store in New Jersey and to buy, you know, shoes for me. And the owner of the shoe store inquired about, okay, who are you buying these shoes for? These are pretty big shoes. And my grandpa was like, hey, it's for my grandson. He's in Jamaica. You know, he's like, well, he must be a tall guy. So they started talking. And so got connected with another guy in New Jersey, Al. And to another in about 3 months, I was in New Jersey. Never played basketball before to learn the game of basketball. This was in June of 1998. So that summer, I was, you know, 16 years old. That summer, went to a few basketball camps. I went to Monmouth University basketball camp. I went to Rutgers University basketball, 2 weeks of Monmouth University basketball camp, 2 weeks of Rutgers University camp, a week at a five-star camp in the Poconos. And yeah, and that was my very first exposure into playing basketball.
So that is, you know, a very much trial by fire immersion type, you know, introduction to the sport.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you spent some time at the five-star camp. What's that like, you know, for a kid that was your age at the time, going from never having touched a basketball to now you're playing all day, every day, these camps, and you're seeing at five-star, there's some decent talent there. How did that go for you? How did you adjust to that? Was it an overwhelm? Tell us about it.
It was definitely a culture shock, a huge culture shock, because you had some really talented guys there, and then guys that thought that because I was 7 foot tall and, you know, that I should. Or you may hear my daughter.
It's all right. Hey, that is a part.
That happens on every one of these now. It's okay. It's a rite of passage.
It's nap time, so you may hear her yelling.
Protesting nap time.
She wants to blow me kisses. Night night. Sorry. my wife's putting her down for a nap. She sees you through the office door. But anyway, so they thought because I was, you know, 7 foot tall that I should be able to do all these things, not knowing that I just started playing basketball like 4 weeks prior.
Right.
And so it was difficult. But it was good because then I got to see a few guys that I know I wanted to to be like. You know, I wanted to get better. I wanted to play on you know, up at their level and be as competitive as you know, as I know they're being right at that point. So it was something that it was definitely a shock, a culture shock.
So you go from that culture shock, and then a couple years later, where you played at Brewster, which there's a local kid, Carter Witt, that's transferred up there for his senior year from here, from Raleigh. But you play at Brewster. Explain to us the process of how you wind up in Chapel Hill. And North Carolina basketball remains to this day to be one of the, you know, it's the thing in this country. Here's Damon Grant from Hope Bay, Jamaica, picks up a basketball at 16 and then at 18 is going to UNC to play basketball.
Yeah, so that's another unique story, and I'll give you a condensed version. If you want to dig any deeper, by all means, you know, you can ask questions. But, you know, so with being in New Jersey, you know, playing basketball camps, I still didn't land in a school. I moved from Miami to Maryland, eventually to New Hampshire. I actually played a year. When I finally started playing organized basketball, I was 18 in Newport Prep School in Maryland. And I played for about half a season before I tore my meniscus. That was the first time I'm actually playing on a team for a school. And I tore my meniscus, and then so I had to have surgery. And then I went to Brewster Academy the year after that, where I, you know, I played my first full year of organized basketball. So it was a year and a half of actual organized basketball on the team platform before, you know, I'm at Brewster, you know, going in, and it was my postgraduate year, and coach Jason Smith at there, Brewster, I got to give him a lot of credit, because I mean, he had a lot of faith in me. You know, he was one of those that he knew that I wasn't the most talented guy, but he knew I was athletic and it's something that he could work with. And once I got to Brewster, met him and his coaching staff, and you know, met a lot of great guys there, you know, was able to start getting the attention from other colleges. You know, start getting, at first it was Coach, he was Coach Quarterbaum that came up to watch practice. Yeah, Coach Q came up to watch practice. And after that, it was Coach Wojcik. He came up to watch practice. And then Coach Doherty came up for a game. I think we were playing, I don't remember the team we were playing, but he came up for a game. And then I remember we lost, and it wasn't, I forgot he was even at the game. I was more pissed off about us losing the game by 6. I mean, it was a competitive team. We were right there. And when we went back down to the locker room, I forgot he was at the game. And, you know, Coach Smith came in and he talked. And then after, you know, he came over and he's like, oh, yeah, by the way, you know, Coach Doherty wants to offer you a scholarship. And I was just like, what? You know. So that was kind of like the journey in a nutshell.
Your thought, you know, is the what, but after it settles in, you clear your mind, you've got a scholarship offer to North Carolina to play basketball. I can imagine that was a pretty big deal those days. It still is, but how do you process that and then walk us through? I mean, was there even a choice after that of where you were going to school, or you know, just how'd you make that decision to come to Chapel Hill?
No, there wasn't a question after that. You know, before I took official visits to like LaSalle University, UMass, Seton Hall University, and before, you know, Seton Hall was kind of like my top contender, I wanted to go to a school back in New Jersey because I considered New Jersey my second home. Coach Louis Orr at the time was a coach at Seton Hall. I really connected with him. And, you know, and I visited the campus. I liked, you know, so I liked Seton Hall at the time. But then when Chapel Hill came in, I remember I took my official visit to Chapel Hill. It was in January. I think it's like January 3rd in 2002, I'm sorry, January 3rd. And it was an ice storm. They just had an ice storm the day before prior. And walking through campus still, I was hooked, you know, given the how beautiful the campus was, the rich Carolina history. It was a no brainer after that. I mean, how can you say no? But if, you know, and I was in awe. I'm still in awe. Like, you know, I feel truly blessed to have, you know, received that opportunity. And I, actually, to this day, I don't feel like I deserve that.
Right. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it definitely is. I'm very grateful for that.
I've got a weird question I want to see if I can push you on just a little bit. So go with me here. You've got a very unique perspective in a sense that you're having to tell folks back in Jamaica, your family, the people that you grew up with, you're telling them about what Carolina basketball is and they have no context. What does that sound like? What is that story? None. How do you relate that to them?
None whatsoever. It still doesn't even connect to that day. It's kind of like saying, hey, you know Michael Jordan? This is where he went to college. Everybody knows Michael Jordan, right? So it's like, hey, this is where Michael Jordan went to college.
You know, that's a global reference. And nobody else gets that. I love that you have that perspective. And I would love to have heard how you told that story to those folks, you know, of trying to relate to, okay, Michael Jordan, and this is the college that he went to. Like that had to have been just nuts to wrap your head around.
You know, it's crazy. It's like when I got recruited, you know, this is one of the things I loved about Coach Doherty. He flew down to Jamaica to meet my parents and to talk to them about me coming to Chapel Hill. And this was actually after I'd even committed. You know, he wanted to be sure that he met my parents, my family, and you know, I thought that was really cool. So, you know, they still didn't really understand. They just thought, hey, some guy coming down, talk to us about our son going to school, you know, playing basketball, and you know, so yeah, they still don't really. You know, one of the things I do regret is, you know, they never had the opportunity to come see me play. You know, at UNC, they didn't get a chance to come to a game, but so that there was still kind of that huge disconnect there. Didn't help the disconnect that was there for them.
Right. So your first experience in Chapel Hill was during one of the tough parts of the program. Yeah, that 8-20 year was just a landmark in a negative way for what had been history for, you know, Carolina basketball and how the entire culture had evolved. What was your experience and what was your perspective in coming in at a time where the program had just kind of hit a low?
You know, I didn't really think much of that. You know, it was just I knew deep down it was just a phase. You know, it was just a rebuilding. It wasn't going to last. You know, and actually on my visit, Carolina played Wake Forest at home and got blown out, you know, but that still didn't deter. I was really excited to get there the next year. And then stepping on campus, you know, with, you know, meeting Sean, you know, Byron, David, Raymond, Rashad, you know, the six of us as freshmen, coming in, it was like, okay, we know what we're here for. We know what we need to do. We know the talent, and we since the very first day, we had no doubt that we didn't consider ourselves saviors, but we knew we can make a huge impact and get the program back to where it needed to be. Especially adding on to, you know, the already core team that was there with Jawad, Jackie, you know, and Melvin.
So you mentioned your class that you come in. That's probably one of the transformative classes there in Carolina basketball history to turn it around. Of course, Jawad, Jackie, and Melvin were part of 8-20, and then we know how their senior seasons ended up. But you talk about coming in and you got the 8-20 to deal with. How did Raymond, Rashad, Sean, I mean, those guys were high-level recruits, successful on the high school level, on the circuit or whatever. How did those guys react from your standpoint? You know what I mean? Seeing – you understood what it was. It was a bump in the road. How do you think those guys – or what did you see from those guys during that time? Because it was a rough stretch. I mean, we've talked to a lot of former guys, talked to Hakeem Nix earlier this weekend, and he said, you know, I never lost a game in high school, period, in football, 4 years. His first year at Carolina, they go 3-9. That's different. How did you see that amongst your teammates dealing with the losses and then the process to get it back?
Yeah, I mean, we're all highly competitive. You know, I mean, if we weren't, we wouldn't have played, you know, basketball or basketball at any level, I don't think. And so being in the gym on a daily basis and knowing that we were pushing each other, and then even our freshman year, when we went, it was what, 18 and
14
and 19 or something like that.
18, 14, yeah.
You know, even that our freshman year with each loss, I mean, it was still pretty difficult, especially after, you know, we went into the season unranked and we started creeping in the top 25. Mm-hmm. You know, we had this now swag. You know, we start, okay, yeah, we're good. We can get this. And then started losing game after game after game and it started really being frustrating. And we all wanted to help each other, but didn't really know how. You know, we all were frustrated because we were losing, but didn't really know how. I felt like we were relying on each, we were wanting to rely on each other, but didn't really know how. It was a coming together of a lot of different talents, a lot of different egos that wanted to rely on each other. I don't think anyone was saying, you know, hey, give me the ball, I'm going to save this deal individually. But it was not really knowing how to make all of those moving pieces work. And that was, I think, the more frustrating piece, because we knew it could work. I'm understanding how to make it all come together.
You know, that's a fascinating aspect. I've done this for Inside Carolina since 98. So I've seen some really good teams, and I've covered that team. And I covered mm-hmm. the one before that. And, you know, as this season's going on, what you describe sort of leads to Coach Daugherty not being there anymore. And I remember being in the locker room, and I've told this story before and I won't go into as much detail. I remember being in the locker room after one of those games you guys lost during that season. And there was a couple guys that were despondent, Rashad being one of them. And my thought was, just as a person, not really as a person covering it, is that somebody needs to – this team needs somebody to talk to, you know what I mean, to get their minds right. And so, anyway, it was just a sort of surreal experience for me personally, seeing guys that are so uber competitive, like you talk about, to be as down as he was in one of those situations. But anyway, so after that season, Daugherty is gone. Coach Daugherty is somebody you've already said you have a lot of respect for. He came to Jamaica. He gets you to Chapel Hill or helps you to Chapel Hill, and now he's gone. Where's your mind at that moment? Because that was a tumultuous time. You know, we could get into the nuts and bolts of the hows and the whys, and a lot of people have a ton of those questions, and I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but.
Yeah, you know, that was definitely very shocking, you know, for all of us. You know, I have a lot of respect for Coach Daugherty, and I, you know, to this day, and I'll tell you why I have a lot of respect for Coach Doherty. I tell this story every chance I get, and I've actually told Coach Doherty himself because I feel like it was important for him to know. Mm-hmm. With me just understanding and learning the game of basketball, I felt like Coach Doherty understood where I was as a player, so took the time to understand where I added value and praise it. I remember there was one practice, and this may seem small to you or to a lot of people. I'd be like, how the hell did you not know that? But hear me out. there was one practice, and I'm going against Sean, and Sean is kicking my butt left and right, getting a rebound and here and then. It's just like I'm getting so frustrated because I'm like, I'm going hard, not letting up. And I can't get the rebound. And coach stopped practice. He's like, time out. He pulled me aside. He's like, Damian, here's the thing. Like when Raymond shoots the ball on the right wing, chances are it's gonna come off on the left wing, right? So if you were boxing Sean out at the top of the key, don't just box him out and stay there. Mm-hmm. Box out, release, go get the ball. So box him, release, go get the ball. Don't just box him out and wait for somebody else to get there. Go get it. So again, you would think that would be common sense, but for someone learning the game of basketball, it's not something that I think about. I think, oh, I box my guy out. I'm close to it. Yeah. If everyone is doing their job and boxing out, then, somebody would get the ball if everyone is doing their job.
Right.
So very next play, I box out, release, and I go get the rebound. Very next play. I remember he stopped practicing. He's like, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. And we all clapped and cheered. You can tell me nothing the rest of practice. As far as I'm concerned, I was the best player on the court. and that was that's a very, when you look at that story, for me, I just had a ton of respect for him in that way. And taking something so small and building on that and understanding what my the things that I brought to the team, knowing that my timing was impeccable, so I can block shots like crazy. I can't, I'm not going to score, but I'm going to block a few shots, and praising me on those key things. And so even with that, I've taken those principles and have applied them, in leadership and business to today with leading a team. So that was one of the things that I truly respected about Coach Doherty, and still have a ton of respect. And I've told him the story because I feel like it's important for him to know how he's impacted me. He impacted me then, even to this day. I felt like then, if I had an issue, I felt comfortable going to him and talking to him about it. The head coach, I didn't like this. Him being real with me about it. So when he got, when I heard that he wasn't going to be there anymore, it was a shock. And I didn't know until we're sitting there on the sidelines, you see that picture of all of us at the press conference.
Yeah.
We found that's when we found out. So a lot of people, one of the things I take issue with, and I'm going to say this here,
mm-hmm. Please do.
There were some people that talked about us being a team of thugs because of how we were dressed and all this stuff. And, we had no respect for the organization. I'm like, we just got back from class. Mm-hmm. We didn't know we were on TV. We were just told, hey, come to the Dean Dome. Okay. And then next thing, we were led out to the court and put in chairs and that's happening. I'm like, wait, what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think there's one of the pitches. I'm sitting there and I'm like,
what in the hell's going on?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a very difficult transition. And especially for me, knowing that he recruited me, not knowing who was going to come in next, is this coach going to accept me knowing developmentally where I am as a player, my background? That was a very difficult time.
So
let me follow, Joey. That's a fascinating story there, and I'm glad you shared it because you're right. A lot of people to this day still talk about that day and the close. And we talked, I mentioned we talked to Jawad a while back, and he talked about that very same situation, about how they, or you guys, were labeled in a certain way because of appearances on that day. So I, you know, I appreciate you sharing it. I know that the people that listen to these podcasts and listen to our stuff will appreciate that perspective, because it never really got told, you know, by, at least by the media, especially around here.
Interesting, interesting discussion. Let me take a break, talk about Johnny T-Shirt and JohnnyT-Shirt.com. They're great sponsors of this podcast, and I want to mention them. I want to mention how important it is for our listeners and our subscribers to take time to support them. If you're Inside Carolina Premium subscriber, you get 10% off your order. But even if you're not, you go to JohnnyT-Shirt.com, and they're constantly having sales, pushing football gear, basketball gear, sports, anything you want from Johnny T-Shirt. Take part online, buy from them, shop local if you're in Chapel Hill and Franklin Street, or shop local if you're in on the other side of the moon. Johnny T-Shirt and JohnnyT-Shirt.com, sponsors of this podcast, and again, 10% off your everyday orders. I'm going to take another break. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Inside Carolina Podcast. I'm Tommy Ashley. Joey Powell's joining me, and we've got special guest Damian Grant. A lot more to come after these messages.
Introducing the Two-Way V4, where groundbreaking fuel cell technology meets fresh foam cushioning for the ultimate performance. With fuel cell, each step feels explosive, delivering unparalleled energy return. Paired with fresh foam, experience maximum comfort throughout the game. Its lightweight textile upper offers support and breathability without sacrificing agility. Whether you're hitting the clutch shot or locking down the opposition, the Two-Way V4 gives you the tools to play at a high level. Learn more and purchase the Two-Way for yourself at NewBalance.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
We're back. You're listening to the Inside Carolina Podcast. I'm your host, Tommy Ashley. Now, let's get back into this. I've got Joey Powell at my side. Damian Grant here is our guest.
So, Coach Daugherty's out. Yeah. It is chaos. There was a lot of discussion about who it would be. We know that, you know, years before or a few years before that, Coach Williams was in the bag, then he wasn't in the bag. And so Daugherty's there. And when you finally get word that Coach Roy Williams is coming back to Chapel Hill, given your background and being a young guy in college on a basketball team, what are you thinking when the news breaks that this guy's coming back from Kansas? And quite honestly, most Carolina fans think he's going to be the savior. Expect him to be the savior, at least from the coaching standpoint.
Yeah, the only thing I thought about was, well, he didn't recruit me when he was at Kansas. So.
I think Jawad said the same thing. Didn't
he? Jawad said the same thing.
So I'm like, okay, so, as far as I'm concerned, he doesn't think I add value. Mm. And so maybe I need to transfer, go somewhere else. And of course, and I'm coming off a freshman season, and I didn't mention this earlier, but I talked about a meniscus tear I had, my in high school. I had another one earlier on in at Chapel Hill my freshman year. So I played through that whole season with a meniscus tear. No one really knows that. Mm. So after the season, I was going to get it repaired. In time. Not sure why, what was the delay with having the surgery, but there was a gap between, when Coach Daugherty wasn't there and when I actually had my surgery. And so I wasn't doing any sort of condition to stay off my knee to get some of the swelling down. So I remember, Coach Williams coming in and he's like, okay, I didn't have any real opinion of him, whatever. I just know, you know, when they announced he was going to be there, they told us to make sure y'all were in suits and, you know, they did the press conference, you know, and that night is when we met him at the press conference. And I didn't really have any real opinions of him. You know, he was there for, you know, like, I think that same week, he said, okay, I want everyone to go through these workouts. I think he even talked about this in his book. Mm-hmm. And so I'm there, you know, meniscus all, my knee shot to crap and, you know, going through these, you know, I'm like, this guy comes in, he wants everybody to go through workouts. So I talked to Skate, our trainer. I'm like, because he wanted me to go through the workouts too, because I'm supposed to be having the surgery. This thing is killing me. He's like, yeah, everybody needs to go through workouts.
For our listeners, so, I wish you could have seen Damian's reaction just now on video.
So I'm like, all right, well, great. So, you know, I'm like, this isn't going to go well. But I'm in the, we're in the practice gym, and we go in there, and I'm mad. You know, and we're going through these workouts, and you know, I'm not in the best shape either. You know, and I remember. I was so mad and wanted to get out of it so bad. We were doing these drills where we threw it off the backboard, do an outlet pass, sprint to the next end and take a shot or layup or something. And I was so mad, I wanted to and take a break, that I just threw it off the wall instead of the backboard. and in his book, he wrote about, you know, how I was so out of shape and whatever, like I completely missed the backboard when I threw it or something like that. Like if he only knew the other side of that story. And I was really surprised that he wrote about that, but you know, whatever. but I mean, I wasn't in any condition to be going. So, you know, I felt that being his first opinion of me, you know, that didn't, I felt like that was working against me. You know, working against a lot of guys. I mean, you know, he was evaluating the team and knowing attempting to figure out what he needed to do. But as a young kid, I didn't really understand that.
So when did it change for you? When did it go from feeling like this, you know, this new guy is coming in that you have no relationship with, he sees this first impression of you, you know, in this workout, however you guys remember it. When did your impression change, or when did you first actually get a chance to connect with Coach Williams?
I just really felt like I connected with Coach Williams. Frankly, it was one of those situations where I felt like I was constantly attempting to figure out where I fit in. You know, with Coach Doherty, again, he pointed that out. You know, he recruited me. He knew where that gap was with Coach Williams. You know, I was still attempting to figure that out consistently. So, you know, I remember just being frustrated with myself because I didn't know where I stood. I remember going into my junior year, you know, 4 or 5 season, and we all know how that ended. You know, I went back before that summer. I went back to New Jersey, and you know, I would go back to New Jersey every summer and worked out with a trainer. You know, with Wes Mayo. Remember, you know, we had our 6 a.m. club, so at 6 a.m. I'm, you know, I'm up working out for our strength training, conditioning, and then with Coach DeBoer. Doing basketball skill training at noon, and then playing in the Pro-Am League in the evening. So, you know, 3 times a day, almost, you know, for about 5 days a week, doing some sort of workout and basketball skill training. So I remember, you know, when I went back to New Jersey and was working out, lost 32 pounds that summer, came back fit, ready to fit in, and, you know, doing what I knew I was supposed to do, you know, came in, did the Carolina mile or the mile and a half run, you know, did that, felt good. Like, yeah, I'm ready. You know, did the the Carolina Mile, which is like a rich tradition. That was actually my very first year doing it, because every year has always been some sort of injury or something. And doing that and got good time, you know, as a big guy. I think I ran it in 6 minutes 15 seconds. Whew. You know, and I'm like, yeah, you know, I remember with each lap, Coach Williams, you know, pushing me, come on, Debo, let's go. You got it. In that last mile. And he was like, don't quit. And, you know, for that last 100 meters, just going all out. And, you know, I remember one of the things he said there, which was one of the very first praises I remember from him. And he talked about, he said that, you know, he felt like I was the one that gave my all, because that very last 100 meters, I was going all out. Like, he felt like everybody was still sort of coasting. Mm-hmm. Like, well, crap, Raymond just ran it in like 5 minutes. You know, but yeah, I figured I'll take it. You know, I remember on the flight out to Hawaii, he was meeting with each player and talking about, you know, grading different aspects, where they are conditioning wise and everything. And where he gave me a B+ for my conditioning and told me how I had improved so much since the prior year, and that now I just needed to work on my stamina. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I remember those specific praises, and I remember just always wanting to do things to figure out where my role was, but didn't really quite get there. I personally didn't feel like I got there.
So when did you feel like, and this is one of the things, I can, just coming from an outside perspective, mm-hmm. I felt really bad, because your knees just never let you kind of be what it seems like you wanted to be. When did you decide that, you know, it physically, it wasn't going to work out? And can you share a little bit about that process with us?
Yeah. So it was, so we had, so the end of my junior year, you know, I had all these nagging injuries. You know, I was out, and I felt like I was ready to come back and play, actually, like towards the end of my junior year, even going into the ACC tournament. Even before going to the ACC tournament, I felt like I was ready to come back and play, but for whatever reason, you know, I never came back. I don't really remember the details of that, but I accepted that. You know, I was practicing full contact practice, but just never dressed to come back. But whatever, I accepted that role, and, you know, we had a lot of fun with it still, and, you know, no hard feelings there. My going into my senior year, you know, that summer, it's like, all right, you know, you have Rashad, Raymond, Sean, they're all leaving. Jackie, Melvin, Jawad, they're graduating. You know, David, Byron, me, you know, this is, all right, time to step up, let's go. And so I'm ready at summer. So we're working, knowing what we have to do, you know, with all the young guys coming in. You know, of course, young guys meaning Tyler. And we know where that led, you know.
That guy was pretty good.
Different kind of young guy.
He's all right. You know, we had Tyler. You know, we had Danny, you know, those guys. That summer, playing pickup, late night pickup, like we always do, came down on Rayshon's, went to block a shot, landed on Rayshon's ankle, and had a high ankle sprain. And it's just, I mean, it was pretty bad, probably the worst pain I've ever felt. And I never fully recovered from that. We were playing in the Bahamas, the Bahamas tour. I just could not. I had no explosiveness. I couldn't run. It was extremely painful. And coming back, I knew, okay, like something is off here. I need to get this really checked out. So did an MRI realized that there were a ton of bone spurs in there. It was restricting movement, mobility, and a lot of scar tissue that was being built up. And, so the doctor told me, it's like, look, you know, we can go in and I can remove some of the bone spurs. But if we were to really repair it like we needed to, you know, have to cut some of the ligaments, you're looking at about a year of physical therapy before you can truly get back and play. So this is the beginning of my senior year, you know, and I'm like, a year? I'm like, okay. So I'm in the weight room one day doing power cleans. And after that, you know, ignoring that, and my ankle gave out. I'm at the top of my snatch.
Oh, that's the worst time.
So, like, now my ankle gave out. I had to throw the weight off me, and I walked out of the weight room, and I'm like, all right, I think this is it. I think this is it. You know, I wanted to. My body was telling me that enough is enough. And, you know, I wanted to be able to, when I get to 40 years old, play with my kids. And so after that, I had surgery to remove some of the bone spurs, not all of them, just the ones that were causing some discomfort, and just be able to walk comfortably. And that's, I decided to hang it up.
Thanks for sharing that.
Let me read you a quote from an article several years ago. It says, I remember setting up a meeting with Coach Williams to let him know I didn't think I'd be able to play the game of basketball anymore. He said something to me that has stuck with me to this day. He said he'd never seen someone fight so hard to be healthy or fight so hard to give so much, but my body just wasn't able to keep up.
Yeah.
That's tough. I mean, and it, from looking at you today, talking about it, it still hurts a little bit.
Well, absolutely. It, I'll share this. It's very being vulnerable, right? You know, we talk about the impact that players should have at UNC, and you know, I kind of felt that it's an honor, you know, when you get that scholarship to play at Chapel Hill. I don't feel like I gave that, you know, what that deserved, you know, because my body just wasn't able to do it. And I knew that there was a lot in there that I had to give. And in my mind, I knew it. You know, I knew how athletic I was. I knew it was at 7 feet, I could jump, you know. I knew, you know, keep my weight down. I knew what I was able to do, but my body didn't cooperate. So yeah, it's tough because I know that there was a lot more. I feel like there was a lot more that I could have given that I wasn't able to.
Well, I'll tell you, I've covered a bunch of athletes, and I don't think I've heard somebody share it like you just did. I mean, to have an opportunity and just to not physically being able to get it done. Yeah, I've seen people say, you know, it is what it is. But to hear you share that version of it, I think it's pretty awesome. And I think I'm glad you shared it. I appreciate that. And
thank you.
Let's talk about life after Carolina. And I mentioned the 40 Club is some weird name Joey and I came up with for these podcasts with former guys. Is, you know, we hear a lot about, you know, it's not a 4-year decision, it's a 40-year decision. You've already talked about what it meant to be a part of Carolina. Just share some more about your life since that day, I believe in September of 2005, you decided, I'm done. I can't do it anymore. What have you been up to since then? And then I want to talk some more about helping your community back in Jamaica and those type things that you've done.
Yeah. Yeah, so I've been in sales since then. You know, now, you know, I'm in the new construction in real estate. You know, I've been extremely fortunate. I've been blessed with, you know, finding something that, doing something that I absolutely love. But finding that over the years after basketball was definitely a transition, because then after hanging up, you know, basketball, it's like, well, okay, well, what now? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think a lot of people struggle, a lot of athletes, I feel like, struggle with that. And, you know, we can talk more about, you know, that's for another show, about that transition, what, you know, post sports, what that should look like for athletes. But that was a struggle figuring out, you know, where do I fit in again now into this real world basketball behind me? And, but eventually landed in real estate and, you know, I'm actually down in Charleston now, heading down there, you know, part of the new home builders as a VP of sales and marketing there. And but it's something that I absolutely love. I really enjoy it. And I find I get a lot of satisfaction out of that. It's as close to basketball as I can get as far as, you know, bringing the team together, celebrating the wins.
Yep.
It's as close to basketball I can get.
So how much has the Carolina family been a part of life since 2005?
Yeah. You know, we all still chat, you know, we're all in a group chat, even, you know, not just my teammates, but old, you know, guys way before me. Shouldn't call them the old guys, way before me. You know, so we're all still pretty close, pretty connected. And, you know, I feel like that's very unique to us. Everyone talks about the Carolina family, they, you know, and you know, what that means. And I think a lot of people and a lot of other schools are envious of that. But, you know, I think for me, and I'll say this, Maktar Jai, he's been instrumental, I feel like, in driving a lot of that and keeping that together. You know, he was one of the first people that made me feel welcome on campus. And I remember I still have, you know, he gave me one of his old practice jerseys when, when I got on campus, because you had to earn your practice gear. You weren't allowed to get any gear until you did like your conditioning stuff. So he gave me his old, you know, one of his old practice jerseys. I still have it to this day. And, but I think he's been instrumental in helping to drive that and keep that together too. But yeah, it's a Carolina family, man. It's something that, you know, I'm also very blessed to be a part of.
I appreciate you kind of sharing a little bit of that insight. Something that I've learned from some of the guys that I knew that played with you and otherwise, they all speak really highly of Debo. All of your ex-teammates that I've ever heard that have talked about you speak really highly of you. Why do you think that is?
You know, you tell me.
I mean, it's hard to, I know it's hard to brag on yourself, but I mean, I can at least see in the time that we've talked to you here how introspective you are and how vulnerable you're willing to be. But why do you think your teammates might just, you know, just think so much of Debo the guy?
You know, I'd like to think I'm pretty humble. You know, it's something that, you know, and I've connected with some of my teammates, and you know, if they need help in any way, whatever it is, I've never asked why. You know, it's always like, all right, let's get it done. If something needs to get done, let's do it. You know, I don't know. Maybe they feel like it's, you know, they can always still turn. You know, they have someone there that's going to be in their corner regardless of whatever is happening. And that's something that I truly believe in, because that's something that I would want for me. If I ever wanted, you know, if I ever need to reach out to someone, I'd want to feel like they're going to be there regardless.
Let me ask you about the current guys a little bit. And I know you guys keep up as much as possible, but Sterling Manley, probably in pretty similar situation than that you went through during your time, struggled to stay healthy. Can't stay healthy. He's got talent to play. What do you tell a guy like that that's nearing the end of his time, eligibility, and he's still trying to get there? I mean, how do you pass that down to a guy like Sterling?
You know, and I don't know a lot of the details about his health situation, but, you know, if it's similar to what I was doing, taking the time to evaluate where you need to be healthy, what needs to happen for him to be healthy. Because a lot of things that I did is I had these nagging injuries that weren't healed all the way that led to other injuries, you know, because I kept pushing to come back and, you know, kept wanting to be a part, not wanting to miss out. So, you know, for him, I would say, hey, understand, evaluate what needs to happen for him to be healthy and take time to do what it takes to be able to do that. You know, if he truly wants to make a solid impact, you know, whether it's sit out for a year or whatever it is, and take the time to work on his body, you know, work on his skill set, and come back being the best player he can be. And then at the end of that, if it still doesn't work out, then he knows, okay, you know what, I've given it my all. That would be my advice to him.
Yeah, it's got to be frustrating to be a young guy that you just can't you can't physically do it. Last question or last couple questions. You mentioned Maktar, and you mentioned him to me out here at the pool when I asked about the group chat or the WhatsApp or whatever, and he's a guy. I think he's not a guy that's very well known to the UNC fan base, other than I've got a picture. I started to get it out. Of him on the scorers table in 98.
Oh, yes.
And, yeah, that made some coaches mad, really up. Some coach's wife really upset that day. She was extremely triggered. But just you mentioned he's sort of the leader. And we tried to put you on the spot to talk about yourself, and I understand not wanting to. But tell us a little bit about Maktar that maybe people don't understand, because – you know, whatever happened with the in Utah, the Final Four, whatever's happened, he's just misunderstood, I think. And I think that's a wrong thing.
He's one of the most humble, most giving guys I've ever met. I think Maktar and even Brendan Haywood, you know, humble, most giving guys that I've met. This is another thing. Going into the Chapel Hill, I didn't really have much, you know. So Maktar and Brendan Haywood, they kind of took me under their wing and kind of like, all right, people, like, help you out. What do you need? You know, hey, I see you don't have a suit. You know, let me help you out with a suit. You know, you don't have these dress shoes. Let me help you out with the dress shoes. You know, and it's something that at even post basketball after college, Maktar is one of those guys where he'd reach out randomly, you know, hey Debo, how's everything going? You know, not so much now, but you know, he was always one of those guys that truly cared. He had no reason to. It was nothing that I could give him or offer him. But he genuinely cared. He wanted to be able to help in whatever way he could and make a positive impact. And I see that now just with everything he does. You know, he's still wanting to be able to do the right thing and be able to have a positive impact in people's lives.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. And Damon, I appreciate you sharing with us today. You know, it was it's crazy to bump into you at swimming pool on a random Saturday or Sunday, but I'm glad it worked out, and I'm glad we got together. And you know, you've been pretty awesome to share with us. I appreciate it.
Hey, yeah. Again, thank you all for having me on and sharing a little bit about my story. I hope I gave you you know, enough details. I know that, you know, maybe the condensed version, but yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Well, one day we'll come back and dig a little deeper and find out a little more. So much to tell. It's funny to it's great to hear those Carolina family stories. And people talk about the family, but it's really the individuals that make it so special, I think. And you're one of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was Damian Grant, former North Carolina Tar Heel. Joey, my takeaways from that interview, he's one of the nicest people you ever meet. I mean, I bugged him at the swimming pool when he's got his entire family there. And B, I think what he said about being a player at Carolina, having a scholarship at Carolina, and he doesn't feel like he lived up to his end of the bargain. How many times have you ever heard that from a college athlete?
I can count them on zero fingers. And I don't know if it's I don't know if it's because he came from such humble beginnings that he has that perspective, but I will say for me, it is very jarring and, you know, it's humbling to me to hear somebody who earned everything he has, you know, when I'm talking about Damian, he's earned everything he has, and to still have that kind of perspective and feeling like, you know, did he really give all that he needed to get that? That's just, oh man, it's a bit of a gut punch, but it's also a really good frame for the rest of us just listening today. I mean, you think about, you hear about all the different sides of who thinks what about college athletes and what they should be paid or whatever, but just his honest, raw opinion and how much he felt compelled to earn that scholarship and earn that time, knowing what he went through physically as well. It's just, that's such a unique, such unique perspective. And I'm so glad he was willing to open up to us.
Yep. He is, he's a good guy. I mean, like I said, totally random meetup turned out to be one of our favorite and one of my favorite podcasts that we've done. I hope our listeners certainly enjoyed it.
You're going to stalk more people at the pool, Tom.
Yeah,
just,
really.
We're getting stalk more guys at the pool.
And we're getting pretty good about this. In the meantime, I'm going to go educate my son and his teenage buddies who Debo is. That was a little embarrassing from the old guy.
Look, man, Friday's on TV all the time. I don't know. How have these kids just missed this? What are we failing? How are we failing as parents?
If it's not on Fortnite and Call of Duty Rainbow, it's not. They don't know anything about it.
Everybody listening to this right now, go rate the podcast. And if you don't go rate the podcast, go tell your kids about the movie Friday and who Debo is. Please, yep. For the love of God.
Indeed. You guys have been listening to the Inside Carolina Podcast 40 Club, something we came up with. It's been pretty good seeking out more former Tar Heels to talk. You know who I'd really like to talk to? That's Mac Tar. We get, yeah, Mac Tar.
Now I feel compelled to hit Mac Tar up because, I mean, Damian spoke so highly of him. We've heard some of the other guys allude to Mac Tar being such a key cog in perpetuating the Carolina family. Yeah. We got to make that happen. Go to his pool. Stalk him at his pool.
Yeah, I think he's a national coach now elsewhere, but we'll do our best to get up with him. If you've got any suggestions, you're listening to this, and got any suggestions or any connections, send them our way. We'll hook it up. We'll do the podcast. Might send you some swag for the hookup. That's Joey Powell. I'm Tommy Ashley. This has been the Inside Carolina Podcast, sponsored by Johnny T-Shirt and johnnytshirt.com. Get that 10% off if you're a premium subscriber. It's worth it. All the Carolina gear you could ever need. Don't forget to leave us a rating, leave us a review, make some suggestions, send me a note, tommy@insidecarolina.com, whatever you need to do to get in touch. Let us know what you want to hear, who you want to hear from. We'll do our best to get it done. Till the next time we meet, see you around.
Thanks for listening to another podcast from insidecarolina.com, brought to you by johnnytshirt.com. Where to go for your next Tar Heel gear purchase.
You can now relive the best moments of the UEFA Champions League 24/7. The UEFA Champions League channel is a new 24-hour streaming channel serving non-stop goals, highlights, and full match replays from the world's most prestigious club competition. Reminisce on your favorite moments, legendary players, and brilliant goals with the UEFA Champions League channel streaming around the clock on Pluto TV and the CBS Sports app.